third case today, which is 99-0056, Yagi versus Carson. Lena, represent Dr. Carson. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is David Pliner of Cornell Law Group. I represent the appellant's petitioners.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. It's green light, it's not on. You're now being timed.
Thank you. I represent Larry Carson, MD, the Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, and the Patients' Compensation Fund. In brief, this is a medical malpractice case that arises out of a carpal tunnel surgery Dr. Carson performed on Mrs. Kathy Yonke on July 7, 1993. The Yonkes allege that as a result of Dr. Carson's negligence during that surgery, she suffered a contracture of her hand, which resulted from the reduced blood flow and the death of muscle tissue during the surgery. The procedural history of this case is somewhat tortured. It's set forth in the briefing. Suffice to say that the Yonkes named one expert witness who was also a treating physician, Dr. Hani Matlu, who was qualified to opine as to Dr. Carson's standard of care. Dr. Matlu was deposed by all defense counsel at length based on his failure to offer any opinions regarding Dr. Carson's standard of care and on his failure to link anything that Dr. Carson did during the surgery with Mrs. Yonke's subsequent problems, Dr. Carson moved for summary judgment. After the motion was filed, the Yonkes moved to name new expert witnesses. That motion was denied by the trial court, and only then did the Yonkes file the affidavit of Dr. Matlu that is at issue in this case. For the first time in that affidavit, Dr. Matlu asserted that he did have opinions about the cause of Mrs. Yonke's problems. He attested that she was suffering from a Volkmann's contracture, which would not have arisen absent failure to comply with the standard of care during the carpal tunnel surgery. The trial court found persuasive the sham affidavit rule as utilized in the Zimbauer case in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, which is the rule that is at issue in this case. The trial court found that Dr. Matlu's explanation for why he was changing his deposition testimony, namely that his opinions at the deposition were based only on limited portions of the record and on very restricted questions, was unsupported as a matter of law by the record, in that the deposition questions were clear and open-ended and not so limited in any way. And based on that conclusion, the trial court granted the motion for summary judgment. The Yonkes appealed. The Court of Appeals reversed. They did not quarrel with the finding that Dr. Matlu's affidavit conflicted with his deposition testimony, but they concluded that it was the province of this court, not the Court of Appeals, to determine whether the sham affidavit rule should be incorporated into standard summary judgment methodology in Wisconsin.
I'm not very familiar. In fact, I'm not familiar at all with this sham deposition rule until this case came. Are there many federal cases that involve this?
There are a number of federal cases, Justice. I do not have a complete listing of all of them.
Reported in the federal supplement and reported in the federal second.
Yes.
And they, I assume, since there is such a rule in these districts that, or in circuits, that there's a debate as to whether it is or isn't sham.
Correct.
Well, is it just easier to go into trial and then dismiss if the doctor's testimony isn't correct?
Well, I believe that if there is a genuine disputed issue of fact, then it is required to deny the summary judgment motion and certainly go to trial. However, I believe under standard methodology, both in Wisconsin and under Rule 56, the trial court must determine as a matter of law first whether there is a genuine issue of material fact. And if there is not, then it is more efficient and I believe fairer to all the parties to end the case at that point rather than trying it and seeing what the jury.
But we're up here, instead of being up here on the merits, we're up here on a procedural matter.
That's true, we are just.
We're going to have to decide whether it's sham or not sham, because everything that's conflicting is not sham, is that right?
Correct.
So should this court be doing that? Why not just try it, get it over with, and once you're going to be up here? Because if you hold against the doctor, you're going to go back to trial.
That's true.
Then you're going to be back up here, on an appeal.
That's true, Justice, in this particular case. I think if we can establish the sham affidavit rule as a part of summary judgment methodology, we may not have to go through that step.
That's why I asked you whether there are a lot of cases in the federal courts, and your response was yes. So there's always, once we adopt the rule about sham depositions, then we're going to be dealing with cases as to whether it's sham or not. We just move the fight back away from the merits into procedural issues.
In a sense, we do, Justice, but I believe that under 80208, the statute is set up for a reason, and that's to dispose of cases that are not that are meritless. And really, in any case where summary judgment is granted or not granted, it may result in an appeal that may be reversed, and we may be back in the trial court again.
Are we going to have to determine whether or not this is a sham? I mean, truly a sham in the literal sense of the word, not the legal sense of the word.
If you mean an affidavit that was intentionally filed for improper purposes?
However the word sham is defined in the dictionary. Are we going to have to decide whether or not this is a sham?
I do not believe so. I believe what we need to decide is whether or not there is any evidence in the record to support Dr. Matlou's explanation for why his opinion changed.
So then, just so that I understand your position then is any time there is a contradicting affidavit by the same witness, that the second affidavit is a legal sham, whether or not it is a literal sham makes no difference.
It's a legal sham only if the recognized exceptions to the rule do not apply.
No. So in the same vein that the other justices asked questions, that the opposing counsel takes the position that, this, as they said, is not a sham, and that these are not even contradictory. I don't quite understand that point, but that's what he's saying, that we're not contradicting, we're just basically supplementing, I believe, is that the accuracy of the second or the affidavit. Is that in question?
That is their argument. We dispute that. The trial court found as a matter of law, and we believe that when you compare Dr. Matlou's explanation for why he changed his testimony to the actual deposition transcript itself, the deposition transcript does not bear out as a matter of law his explanation.
So what you're asking for is that you shouldn't have the opportunity to do any affidavits with the two exceptions. I'm talking about the federal rule has the two exceptions to it.
With those two exceptions and any others that may be deemed appropriate on a case-by-case basis.
So, and it's a question of law for the courts. Trial court's going to look at this paper because it's on paper, right?
Yes.
Trial court can see the witnesses. It's all on paper, right?
Yes.
And if it's appealed, the Court of Appeals will look at it de novo because it's a question of law whether it's a sham.
Correct.
And if it comes up here, we'll look at it to determine whether it's a legal sham. Now, I gather that the courts of appeal around the country are not uniform in their standards. Is that right, to determine what a sham is?
I believe there are different tests that different courts apply.
What are they?
Well, we cited, I believe, from the Tenth Circuit, the Rios case takes into account certain factors in determining whether the affidavit is a sham. Namely, they consider, for example, whether the affiant had counsel present or whether there was an attorney present. representing the interests of the non-movement at the deposition, whether there was an opportunity for that counsel to cross-examine the witness and rehabilitate any problems with the testimony. The two exceptions to the rule that we have cited seem to be, as I read the cases that apply this rule, fairly universal. And there may be others, as I said. We focus on these because I believe Dr. Matloub's explanation falls within one of those exceptions, and that's why we've asserted it.
So even if the contradictory affidavit is the truth, you would have a per se rule that unless one of those two exceptions applies, it goes out.
I would say yes, Justice. I have not found any cases where the courts that apply this rule focus on the subjective intent behind the affidavit and on the question of whether it's accurate or not. They simply look at the deposition testimony and determine whether the questions were clear or not. In other words, whether a reasonable juror looking at the deposition questions and answers could conclude that the witness was either confused or that the questions were so circumscribed that the witness was not given an opportunity to offer their full opinion.
Mr. Plyner, are the federal courts in agreement with the exceptions? Is there any argument or dispute in regard to the exceptions to the rule?
I cannot say for certain, Justice, if every court that has addressed this rule has agreed with it or not. I believe there may be some contrary authority. I don't have that in front of me. I do know that the cases we have cited, the Seventh Circuit applies the rule, the Eastern District of Wisconsin has applied the rule.
So what happens if we don't apply this rule?
Well,
does every circuit apply the rule?
I'm sorry?
Does every federal circuit apply the rule?
I do not know if every federal circuit does. I did not.
Okay. So what if we don't accept this rule? What happens?
If this rule is not accepted, there may be a category of cases such as this one where parties file affidavits solely for the purpose of defeating summary judgment, whether they are genuine or not. And we are not making any arguments or allegations in this case whatsoever about the intent or the genuineness of this affidavit.
Now, if this goes to trial and they don't have a lawyer, they don't have a doctor that can testify to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, or this doctor changes the testimony once again, won't that be frivolous and that will restrain lawyers from doing this? Because then they're going to get socked with a lot of attorney fees.
Well,
are you familiar with the Jarnt case?
I'm sorry, which case?
Are you familiar with the Jarnt case?
Not off the top of my head, no.
It's the case where they brought a cause of action on toxic, if I remember, element, in that they didn't have a witness to show causation for birth defect, if I remember the case, and they were seven, at least the allegation up here, I don't know what happened to it in trial. The lawyer had to pay about $700,000 worth of damages, or at least that. So why isn't that a protection here?
It would be a financial protection, Justice. I think what we also have to consider is judicial economy and the economy of the parties. If we adopt this rule, we can cut off cases that need to be cut off before we go through all of that and before those fees are incurred, and we can save all of that money at the front end.
Mr. Plyner, it's my understanding that the Helen Court in the First District Court of Appeals has adopted basically the rule that you're asking us to adopt. Which came first? Did this case come first and the Court of Appeals wasn't aware until later of Helen, or when was Helen decided? Looks like they're both 1999 cases.
I believe Helen was decided first. I'm not mistaken.
And that's a published case. Why wouldn't that be precedent that the Court of Appeals would have to follow?
There, I believe, was another, at least one other case in the Court of Appeals. which had addressed the sham affidavit rule and concluded that it was a new rule that would have to be adopted by this court rather than by the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals in this case simply adopted that reasoning.
So the one district didn't feel bound by the decision of the other district, apparently.
That would be my assumption, yes.
My recollection is,
didn't the Helen case rely on the Wolski case for its rationale and erroneously relied on the Wolski case, and that's what undermined the strength, if you will, of, in some people's minds, of the Helen decision, because what it cited for the proposition was conceivably an erroneous citation.
I believe that's correct, Justice. That refreshes my memory. I think Wolski is the case that said it was the province of this court and
that's
not
right.
The Court of Appeals.
But Helen cited it for something.
Correct.
It miscited the case, and so that's what its rationale was based on, and that's why I think Helen's brought into question, I think. That's my recollection.
That's correct, I believe, also.
If the court adopts the rule that you're seeking, doesn't it have to go back to the trial court for an evaluation of whether any of the exceptions apply?
I believe the trial court has already made that determination. We had argued the Zimbauer case. We had argued that the exceptions did not apply. The trial court looked at the deposition testimony and specifically found that, contrary to Dr. Matlube's affidavit, the record supported only one single conclusion, which was that he had reviewed all of the medical records, he had consulted with the other physicians involved, and the opinions that he offered were not circumscribed to as narrowly as he claimed in his affidavit. So I believe that if the court adopts the rule, we would simply go back to the trial court for entry of the original order for summary judgment, reversal of the Court of Appeals.
Did the trial court here take testimony and have a hearing?
It did not.
Well, Justice Prosser's question, at least to me, presupposes that these three exceptions would require findings of fact by a trial judge rather than a matter of law. If it had to go back, what should the trial court have done? Should they have? They didn't have to look at anything to see if the affiant was cross-examined, because that would be a matter of the record. That's exception one. Number two, the affiant had access to the pertinent evidence at the time of his earlier testimony, whether the affidavit was based on newly discovered evidence. Would those be on the face of the paper record, or would you have to have testimony?
It would be on the face of the paper record, Justice. There has been no allegation by the respondents in this case that any of the evidence on which Dr. Matlube now purports to rely was discovered after his deposition.
And on the third one, earlier testimony reflects confusion which the affidavit attempts to explain, so that too you'd be totally on the paper record. Is that your...
Correct, in this case, and there may be cases where that is not possible.
Well, are there cases where it's not possible, so you'd have to have a little trial by the circuit court, bring in witnesses? He was or wasn't confused?
If that were the case, Justice, if there were any reasonable basis to read the deposition transcript which would support a reasonable conclusion that the witness was confused, I don't think we would need a separate preliminary trial on that. I think that would be wrapped into the trial on the merits, because by definition that would result in a finding that there was a genuine issue of material fact.
I'm a little disconcerted by the answer that I thought you gave to Justice Babbage. Isn't the rule that you're arguing for to give the court some discretion? I mean, if there's an affidavit that is completely true but doesn't fit into one of those exceptions, are you arguing that the court cannot accept that?
My argument, Justice, is that first of all, the courts that have applied this rule don't look at it as a question of resolving issues of credibility. The federal courts that apply this rule have not looked at it as an issue of resolving questions of credibility of witnesses. I believe that even if the affidavit, if the intent of the affiant is honest, and if they are not attempting to mislead or misrepresent anything, that still does not answer the question of whether or not the explanation that they offer could be accepted by a reasonable person. Someone can attest to some facts, such as that the sun rises in the west. They may believe it, but the court does not have to accept that if the record, as a matter of law, establishes that no reasonable person could believe it. And I believe that's what we have here, because there is no evidence in the deposition transcript, based on the questions that were asked, that the questions were really as circumscribed as Dr. Matlube now claims that they are. And again, the courts that have applied this rule do not do a subjective examination of intent. They simply look at the record to determine whether there's any objective support at all for the assertion.
That seems to be a different answer than what you gave me, right? What's the relevance of whether there's anything in the record to support it? It seemed to me that, let me put my question to you in a little bit different way. Regardless of the truth, honesty, intent, whatever, of the affiant, if it is contradictory to a previous deposition, the affidavit is inadmissible unless it fits within one of those two exceptions. Is that correct?
Yes. My position is that what we look at is not whether the substance of the opinions conflict with the substance of the deposition opinions, but rather whether the explanation for the change is supported by the record. And I believe that's what the courts focus on when they apply this rule. By definition, where the rule applies, there is a conflict in the testimony, or the issue would never even come up. The question is whether or not the evidence supports and the record supports, even remotely, the asserted explanation for the change.
Well, do you really mean to suggest that the affidavit is inadmissible, or do you mean to suggest merely that, because this is not a rule of evidence?
Correct.
You mean to suggest that it is disregarded by the trial court as being capable of creating a material issue of fact to defeat summary judgment?
That would be a more accurate statement, yes.
Okay.
And I believe that's what the trial court did here. He admitted the affidavit and considered it, but concluded it did not create a genuine issue of fact. In summary, if I may, we feel that we are not asking to revolutionize the summary judgment methodology in Wisconsin. One would very much hope that this issue would arise in a rare number of cases. It's not something that could or should be asserted in a lot of cases. It certainly should not be. But that rarity does not change the importance of it, because the goal of summary judgment is to dispose of cases that don't have any merit, and that should not be tried, and that should not incur the time and expense of the court and the parties. This is simply another tool created by the federal common law to help the courts determine if there is a genuine issue of material fact in the unique situation that we have here, where an affidavit is submitted contradicting prior deposition testimony without an explanation which is supported by the record.
Yeah. And counsel, most of the cases, or many of them, deal with party witnesses.
Yes.
This is a non-party witness.
Correct.
Cases hold the same rule applies?
They do. The Zimbauer case that we cited, the Rios case, the Rohrberg case, all apply to medical experts. I believe that an expert witness is retained and paid for their services. In this case, the expert witness in question is also a treating physician. To the extent that the respondents have argued that the incentive for an expert witness to submit an affidavit such as this is not as strong as the incentive of a party, is incorrect under these circumstances. An expert witness has an interest, especially if he's a treating physician, to see that his patient and his client prevails. And if there are no further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Greenwald, representing Kathy Yankee.
Thank you, Justices. My name is Thomas Greenwald, and I...
It's a high tick.
Years ago, when I first appeared before this body, we had a stool that we slid out.
I know. Stood up. I know, it's now high tech.
Your Honor, you addressed a very point that I was going to make as my very first point in this situation. And I think one that this whole court must be concerned with. The genesis of the federal rule came from a fear of people filing false statements. That's what a sham was. As the dictionary defines a sham, there's not a special, quote, legal, quote, definition of a sham. A sham is a sham is a sham. It's a falsehood. It's fraudulently presenting something. Truth is very important. As some of the justices have pointed out, the way that the defendants in this case want this court to apply the rule is to say it's simply because a treating doctor may say something that isn't exactly 100% coincidental with the discovery deposition taken of that treating doctor, regardless if his affidavits are true or not, disregard them. And this young lady who has had a severe injury, who walks around with a hand like this, is to be out of court regardless of the truth. I don't think that this court, I don't think that the history of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is such that we are to disregard the truth in search of procedural niceties. And that's exactly what's being propounded here. Do we need to change the law? Because I don't think anybody has argued that this has been the law. It is not the law. Do we need to change the law? As I argued in my brief, I haven't seen in my 30 years of practice, as of last Saturday.
Congratulations, guys.
Thank you, Your Honor. Any great need, or any need whatsoever. And I've gone from working with Professor Ghiardi at Defense Research Institute to what I'm doing now. I've done both sides of the fence for many years. And I do not see a need. And I do not have not found any article in our bar bulletins, which are excellent bar bulletins, that have proposed a need for this rule. I haven't seen any of the committees that we have on rules of evidence and rules of procedure suggest that we need to have such a rule.
What protects clients? What protects Dr. Carson?
That's exactly what I was going to mention. What we do have is from sham pleadings. We have this protection. We have the protection provided under 802.08, subsection 5, affidavits made in bad faith. The doctor's time, effort, his attorney's time, effort can all be rewarded, or he can be compensated for that if, in fact, these affidavits were presented in bad faith. And, of course, there's no showing. And as counsel suggested, he's not even suggesting that these affidavits were submitted in bad faith. There's also a second step. The Jarge case. Most of us read it. Most of us have concerns with it. We have all read, and I'm sure the justices have read, former Justices Jeanine Jeske's most recent comments on it. Whether it is right or wrong, it is now the law in this state. If that doesn't cool somebody's heels, to speak in the vernacular, to speak from someone who's in the pits representing injured persons such as myself, from doing something that would be improper, that would be a sham, I don't know what else would. I mean, my good friend and former classmate seeks a heavy penalty dependent upon the trial court. And that was not at the end of a trial. That penalty was imposed for actions not taken within 45 days of the action being filed. So quick and prompt action can be taken where it appears that there is a real sham. It was taken in the Jarnt case. It was taken even before summary judgment stages, I believe. So there is very adequate, very ample, and very strong protection against sham pleadings being filed. I think another thing that is important, especially in this case, we were presented with this argument as oral arguments began on the motion for summary judgment. It was the first time it was raised, first time it was brought to us that they were even contesting our affidavits. Are we then to have to try and have a separate trial and more affidavits on the affidavits? We get ourselves into a real Donnybrook on a procedural matter, when the real question is, does the affidavit raise an issue of fact? If it raises an issue of fact, it ought to be accepted. If the court subsequently determines that it was merely a sham, penalties can be imposed. But to apply the law as suggested by the defendants in this matter is not necessary in order for this court to control sham pleadings, nor is it necessary to apply that rule in order to have quality, cogent, and competent decisions by the trial court or by the Court of Appeals or by this court
also,
on motions for summary judgment.
As a practical matter, I existed once as a trial judge, and I was thinking that, okay, you have your hearing.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
You have your hearing on the motion for summary judgment, and all of a sudden counsel, we have a problem, and wants to, quote, supplement the record. What about the cutoff, the finality, the idea that, this is the hearing, you should be ready for it, everything should be here, because does an affidavit, whether it's sham or not, is that followed by another affidavit? Is there some cutoff if we have this supposed difficulty in not stopping the truth? In other words, the truth is a matter of opinion sometimes, as you know. I'm just talking about you have the hearing set as a practical matter for the trial judge to say, oh, yes, you can file something else here, and then we'll take a look at it.
Well, in this instance, it came up by the filing of a response to our affidavits and our brief in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, which I was handed after arguments began.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You'd limit it to this, because I'm thinking if you have a hearing, on the motion for summary judgment, are you suggesting that there should be some cutoff as far as when you can come in with an affidavit?
I think that what the real procedure that should be followed is that there should be a motion to strike or disregard the affidavit so that now you can concentrate on that. We had no opportunity to concentrate on that whatsoever in the trial court in this matter. I mean, we're handed the brief that raises this argument as we're in oral arguments on the motion. There was no opportunity. And, of course, the law had been that the federal exclusionary rule had not applied. And so we were defenseless, so to speak. Fortunately, I felt that it was necessary in presenting the affidavits to give some explanation, or the witnesses, I can't remember exactly how it went because it was 2 years ago now that I met with them, three or four times, I believe, in drafting and redrafting, etc., these affidavits. And I can't sit here and take the credit for suggesting their explanation, or if that was a statement that they wanted to make or what, whatever. You do have in your record their statements as to their reasons for submitting these affidavits. Going now, I think the most important thing, and the other matters is how far do you extend the rule if you do adopt it, has it applied in this case, etc. I really argued, I think, in my briefs, but the main issue is this necessary for the protection of our trial court system? And it hasn't been. And I don't see how it can be now, or is it necessary now? If we decide to have some type of rule, if this body decides to graft onto 802.08 and the well-established rules on the methodology of summary judgment, which would allow a trial court to disregard, strike, ignore an affidavit, how far do we go? Do we go beyond, do we strike it just simply because it's contradictory? Or do you have to establish that it's a sham or false, as some of the circuits suggest that you must do, a rule that you must do? The Seventh Circuit is not one of those circuits. The Seventh Circuit almost states in its last decisions, although they weren't clear on this, if it's an opposite, if it's contradictory, it's to be disregarded. Do we go that far? Do we apply it beyond a party? The rules, as initially said, well, you know, these things are drafted by attorneys and their clients just sign them. Do we go beyond a party and a retained expert witness? We don't have retained expert witnesses in this situation. We have the treating physicians who have certain opinions. They're subsequent treating physicians. They haven't been retained to analyze and to give opinions. They were the treating physicians.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes, Judge. Justice, I'm sorry.
80208 is supposed to parallel Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56C.
Yes.
You cited 802085, affidavits made in bad faith.
Yes.
As a way to address the true sham affidavit.
Yes.
Is there something in Federal Rules of Civil Procedure equivalent to subsection 5?
Yes.
And did it precede the development of the sham affidavit rule?
I don't know, because the first case came in 1969, and I believe the federal rules were subsequent to 1969. I hadn't considered that point even as to the time span, and maybe I should have, but I'm sorry I did not. My belief is that these federal rules were adopted after the sham rule started coming into the law, because I think the first case was 1969.
1969.
Yeah. But I was not unattuned to the argument that could be made that, look at, our statute is the same. But because the federal statute mirrors our statute, does not mean that this court should mirror the decisions of several of the Court of Appeals. There's been no ruling by the United States Supreme Court on this matter, definitively. And not all the circuits are in agreement with the rule or the extent or the nature of the rule. It would not be the first time that our courts have refused to follow the circuit courts of appeals deciding similar legislation. Probably the most obvious is the Daubert rule. Our courts have continued to reject not only the Daubert, but the rule, the federal rule that pre-existed Daubert. I'm drawing a blank on it now, but it's always cited in the Daubert case.
Fry.
I was going to say Fritz, and I knew it wasn't Fritz. The Fry rule. Thank you, judges. We've seen fit not to adopt Daubert, not to adopt Fry. And merely because the federal courts have seen fit to adopt a rule should not require our state, which has our own jurisprudence and our own independence from the federal government, to follow its own rules. This state has a history of being itself and being its own thinker, from W-2 to Fry. And I think that this state, the judges in this state, the parties in the state, the residents in the state, continue that ability to have that independent thought and process. And we can complete the business that we have to in our government, in our courts, without the imposition of a federal rule. Going back to the question of how far do we extend it as far as who is the person signing it? Lane v. Celotex is the only real decision that's really made any recognizable analysis of the wisdom or non-wisdom of trying to extend this beyond this rule beyond the parties. In that decision, Justices Hill, Fay, and Tuttle, as I quoted on page 12 of my brief, said, in PERMA research, Radobenko, Kenneth Murray, and Van T. Junkins, the four principal cases, the contradictory affidavits submitted by a party, and thus the possibility of sham factual issues, was raised. Here there is little chance of sham factual issues. Ring is a disinterested witness, and it is our view that any inconsistency in his testimony is more likely the result of his faulty memory than a predisposition to lie. Thus, while a district court may find that a party's contradictory affidavit constitutes a sham, e.g., Van T. Junkins, 736 Federal 2nd at 656, we would be unable, absent great trepidation, to affirm a similar finding with respect to a disinterested witness's contradictory affidavit. And if we look at the only two Court of Appeals decisions to have discussed the application of the rule, it's not the only two that have applied the rule to non-party witnesses, but the only two that have really discussed the application of the rule to a non-party witness, as I discussed on page 10 and 11 of my brief, all they've said is, we see no reason not to apply it beyond party witness. I think Justices Hill, Fay, and Tuttle have clearly demonstrated cogent reasons, important reasons, not to apply it beyond the plaintiffs. It is one thing to have my client sit down and sign something that I drafted and tell him to draft. It is another thing for me to go into a doctor's office, practicing physician's office, and see if doctor, here's this affidavit, just sign it. That doesn't happen in real life. Believe me, in the number of years that I've practiced in this area, I have found that to be true. It is hard to get 10 to 15 minutes of a doctor's time when we have a serious illness, when we come into his office for checkup. Much less to get a doctor's time to do an affidavit. If they're going to look at an affidavit, if they're going to sign an affidavit, they're going to look at it closely. It's not going to be something which you can just get them to sign without even thinking about it. This is a professional person. So I don't think that it should, even if this court was to apply some form of the exclusionary rule, it should not be applied in this instance. It should not be extended to situations where it's not a party or situations where the witness is strictly a hired gun, so to speak. As I've argued in my brief, the affidavit must be a sham. It must be more than mere contradiction. I've cited quoted from some of the decisions saying that it can't be simply a contradiction. It has to be a sham. I've argued this point, so we'll go beyond that. Finally, if we look at the affidavits in this question, even if we were to adopt such a liberal rule as the Seventh Circuit seems to have adopted, i.e., any witness, any contradiction, you disregard the affidavit, unless you meet the exceptions. I think the matters which we've set forth in our brief clearly demonstrate that the rule would not apply to these affidavits. The language in the opinions, and these are opinions, not facts. We're not dealing with a situation where the plaintiff puts in an affidavit contradicting a fact matter. So we're not talking about lies. We're talking about opinions. We're talking about changing, even being able, can experts never change their minds? Can they never change their opinions? That's a sad point, side point. But in this situation, the opinions that are expressed in the affidavits were not even questions that were asked of the doctors in the depositions. And what we really find is we begin with the attorneys for the defendants asking Dr. Girardi to assume that a certain hospital record is correct, as opposed to anything else he may have heard, saw, or considered. Assuming that's correct, can he say that the tourniquet, we're not talking about any other type of things that could have injured that arm, but can the tourniquet itself be a reason for the development of the Volkmann's contraction? And his answer was, assuming that to be true, the tourniquet would not have caused the injury. But there's the blood pressure cuff, there's the surgery itself. We don't know. We don't know the specifics because we weren't there. Only the doctors were there. The treating doctors that are doing these affidavits weren't there. But we go from doctor assuming this one record is absolutely correct. Do you agree that the tourniquet, the application of the tourniquet, cause of the injury? They build on that and all the way through with Dr. Girardi, and then they go to Dr. Matt Lube and they say, do you agree with what Dr. Girardi said, which is based upon an assumption? And then after he says yes, then they conclude that therefore he can't give any opinions at all based on other information or based upon other facts. And I think that's clearly inappropriate. This is where the name game was played to its hilt by defense counsel. There was one question asked. This isn't as in some of these other cases where time and again in the deposition, the doctors asked without any limitations, without asking to assume what other doctors had said, without asking to assume the credibility or the accuracy of any one document. Doctor, do you have any criticism with respect to the care provided by Dr. J, the defendant? No. And that's asked throughout the deposition, multiple occasions. We don't have that at all in this situation. We don't have that at all. We don't have the doctor being asked, doctor, can this condition develop following a surgery in the absence of negligence by the treating physician? We don't even have that question. which are some of the very opinions that are set forth in the affidavit. I'm not going to belabor this point any longer, because I'm certain that you all have read it, but our final position is these affidavits, when properly looked at, when correctly looked at, would not be excluded by the federal exclusionary rule. In conclusion, it's not necessary to adopt this rule. I do not believe that this court should adopt this rule and alter long existing methodology of handling summary judgment and Wisconsin statute section 802.08. It's not necessary for the protection of the court, for the protection of the parties, for the protection of our society. We have penalties that can be imposed upon attorneys that like to submit false documents or mislead the courts. And those, as we've just seen in Charter, can be very extensive penalties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwald. Mr. Fenner?
I have three brief points in response, if I may. First, the primary issue, as stated by the respondents, is why do we need this rule? We need this rule because under 802.08, as under Rule 56, a defendant, or plaintiff for that matter, is entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law if there is no genuine issue as to material fact. The federal courts that have applied the sham affidavit rule have said that the rule is necessary in order to preserve the utility of that right, because if a party can, or a witness can submit an affidavit that contradicts without a valid explanation the party's or the witness's prior testimony, then that could happen in literally any case, and summary judgment would never be granted. And that's why we don't, I believe, get into the question, or why the federal courts don't get into the question of subjective intent, because it's much more efficient and simpler to apply a rule at the outset that applies to all such affidavits if there is no valid explanation supported by the record to justify the change in the testimony. And that's the key here. If a jury could find, by any stretch of the reasonable imagination, that Dr. Matlew really did misunderstand the questions, or that the questions really were so circumscribed, then there'd be a genuine issue of material fact, and we would not need a separate trial on that question. We just go to the merits. And the jury could either believe Dr. Matlube's testimony at trial, or they could believe what he said in his deposition. Secondly, the respondents raised the question of whether this rule should apply to witnesses versus parties. As the rule is stated by the courts, that really isn't that important of an issue, because what it always comes down to is whether there is any evidence in the record to support the explanation for the contradiction. And the Lane case, which they rely on, I believe the witness in that case, there was evidence from which the jury concluded that his change in testimony was based on faulty memory. We don't have anything like that here. We simply have a deposition transcript where the doctor is asked clear and open-ended questions. And that brings me to the final point, which is the respondent's assertion that really the testimony here does not contradict, or the affidavit does not contradict the deposition. I can only cite portions of the transcript as evidence, pages 28 to 29 of the doctor's deposition. He was asked, in summary, that he, Dr. Girada, who was the plaintiff's other expert, Dr. Gruner, the psychologist, who had evaluated the plaintiff, they all tried to find out what caused this post-surgical problem. They all did tests. Third parties, such as the Mayo Clinic, analyzed the test results, and they were asked, have you come up with a conclusion as to what caused this problem? And he said, no. And he specifically said, you are not able, he was asked, you are not able to say that anything that occurred at the time of the carpal tunnel surgery in July 93 caused her contracture. His response was correct. Now, that response was presumed that the records were accurate, but as we detailed in our reply brief, there's no evidence that they were not. And I think it's significant that that testimony on pages 28 and 29 of his deposition is not addressed in his affidavit. He cites certain pages of his deposition where he specifically says his testimony was so limited. And in particular, he cites pages 22, 23, 24, 26, and 32 of his deposition transcript, where he says, well, my responses were only based on limited information, not on everything that I've looked at. He does not mention 28 or 29, which is where he is asked really some of the broadest questions of all. And then finally he is asked, is it accurate to say that you do not have any criticism of the standard of care utilized by Dr. Carson in his care and treatment of the patient? Answer, that's correct. If the court looks at the questions and answers that preceded that question and answer, no reasonable juror could conclude that Dr. Matlew could reasonably believe that his testimony and the questioning was circumscribed to certain records or to certain statements by other doctors. So I reiterate, this is a rule that would have limited application. It's not intended to get rid of meritorious claims.
If we should not adopt that rule, does your client lose at this level?
Does our client lose in the sense that it would go back for a trial?
Yes.
On the question of whether there was a disputed issue of fact. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions? With that, we end our oral argument on Yankee versus Carson. And we are recess until the decision conference is December 31, 1945.
Summer gets longer and longer.
I'm not objective.